Hello, I'm Matt Baume, and welcome to The Sewers of Paris. We're on a podcast search for the entertainment that changed the lives of queer people. On tonight's episode, Twilight, Sonic the Hedgehog, and queer comedy. My guest this week would like you to see him at his worst. Ian Lockwood is a New York-based pop music comedian who makes goofy music videos in which he plays his messiest self. It's a style inspired in part by his relationship with the Twilight novels, which he started reading as a joke and was then startled to discover that he unironically loved. We'll have that conversation in a minute. Don't forget to check out my YouTube, where I post videos about queer pop culture history. I've got one coming this weekend about how queer activists teamed up with the producer of Bewitched and Barney Miller to overcome network censors and put the first recurring gay couple on television. You can also head over to my Patreon to watch hours of bonus videos featuring stories of queer TV, film, and Broadway history. Also, check out my cute little newsletter, where I share sneak peeks at what I'm working on next at mattbaume.com. Big thanks to everyone who supports The Sewers of Paris at patreon.com/mattbaume, and to everyone who's left a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Now, here's Ian. Well, this week I'm talking to a musical comedian, Ian Lockwood. Thanks so much for joining me.
Hello, thank you for having me, Matt.
So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
Twilight, the books and films.
I'm so excited. I cannot wait to talk about this stuff. So how did Twilight enter your life initially?
Initially, just through the craze of the books. Everyone was reading them. Everyone knew about them. And it was, I think, I thought about what I wanted to talk about for the last weekend. And I pretty quickly landed on Twilight, but it took thinking about it for the entire weekend for me to realize why that was so strong in my brain. Because at first I was like, oh, that's just a quick, simple, silly thing. But then I realized it had a pretty profound effect on me and on my story of coming out as a gay man, in that the Twilight books were not quote unquote for boys. Like it was truly a betrayal of the illusion of being a straight young man to also be reading Twilight. And I didn't quite know that about myself young, but it represented a really significant line crossed, I realized.
Wow. So how old were you when you started reading them?
I must have been an early teen. I must have been like 13 years old. So those feelings were starting to bubble up.
I like definitely remember being like there being like a real misogynist, sort of like, oh, it's for chicks. It's romance, you know, like sort of like, oh, it's beneath us because it's women's literature. So like what brought you to the books? Like, how did you discover them?
I think I mean, throughout my life, I've done a lot of things, quote unquote, as a joke. And obviously, and that also became like an incredible defense mechanism for me. If I ever was curious about something, I could just do it as a joke. And so I think I started reading them, quote unquote, as a joke, but also curious about kind of what these forbidden texts were, because you're right, it was like completely a misogynistic conversation around consuming that media. It also fully went to the realm of don't read Twilight, that's gay. So,
oh, yeah.
I think it being that is what made it kind of irresistible for me to check out and to start it as a joke.
So for folks who somehow are not familiar, or maybe, I don't know, they've avoided it because of the stigma, what was in those books and what were you responding to? Like, as a kid, what were you reading that, or as a teen, what were you reading that you were like, oh, wow, I actually love this and I'm thinking about it and I want to come back to it?
The Twilight books and movies are a series about a human girl who moves to Forks, Washington, and falls in love with a vampire boy. It's a very schlocky romance. It's true camp. There are some, I don't want to get into this too much today because it's been covered in depth so well, but there are some like religious themes and religious contexts around it. But the result is that it's a very, very safe romance for anyone who might self-insert as like a high school girl, which, as we're pretty familiar with, high school gay boys will absolutely self-insert as a high school girl.
Sure, yeah.
So it was this safe, sexy, sensual thing that intersected with camp and sort of superheroes. And it was just a huge phenomenon at the time, and everyone couldn't stop talking about it.
Yeah. Like, was it something that you felt like you had to hide from people, or like, did you have other people that you could talk about? Did you have your Twilight friends?
Yes, and that actually kind of was another important line for me, especially with the movies. But first of all, yeah, at first it was like, keep my enjoyment private, easy defense mechanism of pulling out the book and being like, haha, guys, look what I got here. Isn't this funny that I have this? I was also doing theater in high school and meeting a lot of incredible women who would become my friends forever. And I was sort of able to tag along with them to the premieres of the movies that they were excited for. And it was a really great way to dip my toe into the future of what I would be doing. I was experiencing this with them for the same reasons that they liked it. And mm-hmm. they brought me along and they were extremely kind. And I had sort of a safe space with these women who let me tag along.
You know, I think a lot of queer people experience a thing where they're like, oh, I'm the funny one. Like, I can make people laugh. And that makes either it protects me or it diffuses the riskiness of what people might detect in me. Like, were you known? Like, were you a comedian or were you like the funny guy back at the time?
Yes, absolutely. I was the class clown. I was always making noise. I was very eccentric. And everyone sort of assumed that I was gay. But I think I probably didn't even know the meaning of the word irony at that point. And yet it was sort of my entire personality for my childhood was kind of mired in irony of this protection of, oh, I'm the funny one. Anything I say I could be joking about, I can backpedal from anything. And it was really helpful in hiding those queer feelings. And I got to, you know, say things or express things or try things and then back off and say, I was kidding. Obviously, I joke all the time. Mm-hmm. Everything's a joke to me.
This is not totally dissimilar from my own experience with Spice World, which came out when I was in high school. And
yeah.
I remember, like, you know, I was very much a part of the like, oh, Spice Girls, oh, it's so mainstream. And then two of my friends went to see the movie and they like dressed up for it. And like, I think that might have been the first time it occurred to me that people could unironically like what was considered like low culture. And again, like, you know, it's considered for women. And I think there was a stigma attached to it because of that. And
yeah,
that it was actually like pleasurable to like something that other people were like, oh, it's so bad.
Yes, exactly. I too, by the way, was a huge fan of Spice World. My older sister loved the Spice Girls and got me into them. Who was your favorite Spice, by the way?
Oh man, who is my favorite? I think it was probably Ginger.
Ooh,
and I don't know
okay.
why.
Interesting.
I think I liked her shoes, but like there was in my college dorm, there was a giant Spice World poster that we'd put up at first, like, haha, as a joke. But then like, you know, I genuinely developed strong affection for this movie. And I've probably seen easily more than a dozen times now. Yeah, I think it was like, I liked her, you know, they all had these very boiled down personalities, but I think I liked her spunkiness.
Okay, fair. I was a baby. Oh, I shouldn't say I was a baby lover. I was a baby Spice lover, and sort of considered myself to be baby Spice, obviously. But yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I meditating on Twilight for a few days. I kind of am asking myself: is camp and schlock like inherent to being a queer person? Because
it's like that question's come up a lot on this show, and you know, I don't have a good answer, but I mean, I think you're, you know, and just thinking about it, it sounds like you're experiencing something that a lot of other people have noticed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like, I mean, it's a huge part of our culture, but I'm realizing that irony and camp and schlock manifested for me as a child before I had names for those concepts. Like you said, it was like, oh, I can like this because it's lowest common denominator, or I don't know, something about it excites me. I don't have to have a good reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's the, you know, Susan Sontag wrote a whole article about this, but like mm-hmm. the extremity of the aesthetic, there's just something really appealing about it. And there's something inherently, I think there is something inherently like queer about it, you know, using queer in sort of an academic term, but you know, mm-hmm. for a group of people who are outsiders and who are forced because there will always be a minority in some sense, to, you know, have a way to, I guess, subvert, this is getting really academic, to subvert like what is popular and what is trendy and to delight in the failures of the seriousness of that culture. I think, gosh, I don't know. That just gives me such a joy.
Yeah, me too. I don't know what my life would be like without some sort of schlock or ironic enjoyment of things.
What other stuff, like, you know, looking back, did you like? Like, what other campy interests did you have?
Interestingly, I sort of found myself in video games. I think that was a great way for me to sort of maintain my straightness of as a child, just relate to my other, you know, boy friends. So it was a lot of video games a lot of the time. And the storytelling in video games is also, like, really campy and very, very fun. I almost brought in, I thought I probably don't have enough to talk about it with how much I'd have to replay the game. But Sonic Adventure 2 Battle is a Sonic the Hedgehog game that has a huge story. You play as the good guys, the bad guys. It's an epic, and revisiting it, it is not a good game, but I love it.
What? So I don't think I've ever played that one. Is it more of like a Sonic RPG?
Not exactly an RPG, but it is like a 3D Sonic. It is not a side scroller. There are these huge story beats, a really dramatic story. Actually, oh, it's coming to me. The whole story seems to be about Sonic now has sort of an evil twin, but this evil twin, Shadow, also has this like devastating backstory where he was an experiment on a space station and he fell in love with the research assistant who showed him kindness, and then she sacrificed her life for him.
Okay, that's a little heavier than like the round ball that goes fast.
Oh, absolutely. But in this cutscene, there are so many great campy moments. There's a cutscene in which he's flashed back to it and he yells her name and he goes, Maria! Very, very entertaining.
You know, and not to get too analytical about it, but I don't know, like there's my other half who has like a dark secret involving a forbidden affection. Boy, that really does seem like it's just like written for the queer kids who are playing the game.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. There's all of this media for teens that is like sexy, but secret. And it's a great place to self-insert as a queer teen.
Yeah. You know, there's a part of me that wonders like what kind of a job the movie Cats is going to do on like the teens who see it, like at the impressionable age. Like it's really, you know, it's speaking of like campy culture, like it's another movie that I just adore, the Cats movie. And I wonder like I remember when it was coming out, people were like, well, this is going to create a whole new generation of furries and like a very specific variation on that. And I feel like, you know, the media that comes along, like just at the right moment when you need it really makes a mark on how you think of yourself.
Oh, absolutely. And I definitely found more comfort in more fictional, leaning media, you know, fantastical Cats, superhero stuff, video games. And I do think it's like, it's easier to sort of see yourself in stories that kind of paint no one, kind of paint everyone. I mean, I suppose there are genders in the film Cats, but they kind of melt away compared to everything else that is in your face. So I think you could sort of identify with any character you want to in Cats.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, in whatever version you want to, like whichever version of Cats is your favorite. You mentioned that Twilight played a role in your coming out. So what was that and what was that process for you?
It was just that it crossed those two lines. First, the line of doing something that was fatally gay. Like there was no getting out of the fact that reading all the Twilight books was, in my mind at the time, gay. And so I had committed a gay sin. There was no going back from that. And sort of, you know, if anyone, it was, the movies came out through when I was in high school. So people all the time would bring up like, oh, who likes these? Who read these books? And I could immediately essentially out myself if I said I read all four books. So it was sort of like, it was a piece of media that, as schlocky as it might be, sort of was the first thing that I was able to hold on to and be proud of, I guess, and be happy about enjoying. Like, I feel like the kids who have Drag Race for that nowadays must get it so much quicker. But yeah, I was sort of I really did enjoy those books, honestly, and I was happy that I enjoyed them, and I enjoyed them enough that it didn't really matter that it meant that I was gay to like them. So that was huge for me. And then the other part that it had in my coming out is just, yeah, getting me surrounded by women who shared my interests and realizing that as scary as it might be to possibly lose all of my male friends upon coming out, I was not going to be alone.
Was that a real concern for you that like your friends would be like, all right, well, he liked Twilight, but now we know that he's gay, so forget it.
No, honestly, I don't think it was a huge concern of mine. I actually grew up in an extremely liberal area in Southern California, and I had a bit of a reverse effect to the same effect of people would tell me, I very rarely got bullied for presenting gay. It happened a tiny bit, but really not very often. But what I did get all the time was parents, teachers, and peers telling me that if I did so happen to be gay, that would be fine. And I would, of course, that's a nice thing to say to somebody, but when you are desperately trying to not be gay and somebody tells you monthly that, hey, it's cool to be gay, you seem like you might be gay, don't worry about it if you are, it can have a little bit of an effect of pushing you back in the closet.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Especially when you're a teenager and the worst thing you can do is something that adults say is all right.
Yeah, exactly. Or the worst thing you could do is prove everybody right about you when you just want to rebel. Yeah.
Right, right. Well, it turns out everyone was able to analyze me better than I could myself, which is, I mean, that's life.
Yeah, but unfortunately.
It's an uncomfortable thing to come to the realization that, you know, people can perceive you.
Yeah, exactly. Unfortunately, I hate being perceived.
What was your actual coming out? Like when did you had the point of no return with the books, but then what was your actual coming out?
I had an interestingly late coming out compared to my area. There were gay kids in my high school who were popular. I should have just come out. But I was definitely figuring it out for a while. When I was 20, in my second year of college, I was still seeing my high school girlfriend long distance, and these feelings started to sort of bubble up, and I wanted to explore them. And then I ended up coming out as bi first, and that is how I truly felt at the time. But then upon trying things with other men, I sort of went, okay, maybe I'm a little bi, but I am really enjoying this. I'm gonna stick with this. So that was admitting it to myself. Then told friends and was very quickly accepted. I was at NYU at the time, so nobody had a problem with it. But came back for summer vacation after that year of college, and went on a date with a guy. Told my parents at the dinner table that I had a date that night, so I wouldn't be sticking around. And they said, oh, what's her name? And I said, his name is Michael. Anyway, and I quickly finished my dinner and got out of there. And they both very nicely told me afterwards that that was fine and they still love me. So all in all, really not traumatic compared to a lot of people out there. But I think, I mean, having to do it at all, there is an inherent amount of trauma. It's so anxiety provoking.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, especially with people telling you like, well, we know what you are. And there's like the stress of being like, well, the thing that I've been avoiding that you've been telling me, I now have to confirm your suspicions. But also like just not knowing how people are going to respond, as nice as they seem like they're going to be, like you just never know.
Yeah, you never know. But I mean, I was sort of already interfacing with all of this media and all of these. Everybody would ask me all the time if I was gay, and I'd be like, no, interesting. People ask me all the time just because I look like it, sound like it, and all of my interests line up. How strange.
You know, you just reminded me of when I was in high school, somebody asked me the same thing. And this is before I was out even to myself, when I was still like, am I? No. Well, maybe no. There was some girl who asked me if I was gay, and I was like, no. And she's like, I think you are because you're funny. And like, even then in that context, I don't know what it was, that there was just sort of this understanding that, like, oh, gay people are like comedic, or they're jesters in some strange way. Like, I don't know, maybe it's because, you know, you'd see them on sitcoms here and there, and that's like,
yeah,
maybe that's where people got their ideas from.
Yeah, and there is that long tradition of gay and queer people being jesters and getting the heat off of them that way. So it does kind of line up. I have a feeling that the Gen Z kids are not assigning those givens in exactly the same way. I need to do more research, but I'm not sure. I feel like those attitudes might be dissolving just a tiny bit.
Now, there was, you know, now that, you know, after you'd come out, did you have like gay role models or gay characters and things? Because I don't think there's anything in Twilight that is like explicitly gay. Like, the subtext is not very subtextual, but there's nothing actually gay in Twilight, I don't think, right?
Not really. I think the reason that I mean, it's so easy to self-insert to a high school girl as a high school gay guy. And the thing about Twilight, there's some debate about whether this was done on purpose and it is extremely, you know, clever and manipulative to do. But the main character is Bella. The main character, Bella, is so ripe for self-insert that she's described as brunette and plain and pale and quiet, but not too quiet, and quiet except when she has something to say. And so the reason I think I identified with that so much is it's also that the two romantic leads desire her carnally. No matter what, there's nothing she could do to stop them from loving her. They pursue her. And it's kind of in spite of her being written pretty uninteresting and plain. And so it's so easy to self-insert that the gayness of Twilight for me came out of, wouldn't it be interesting if these two men were pursuing me past the point of all of my defenses of, no, I'm weird, or I'm plain, or I'm gay, or I'm male. And what if they were just so in love with me that they had to have me? And that's sort of the gay relation there for me.
Right, right. And I know that she's sort of like made to be, I think somebody once described the character of Bella to me as being like extra medium. Like, she's just sort of,
yes,
for a certain type of reader, she's just like at the intersection of a lot of different things that you can be like, oh yeah, that's me, and that's me, and that's me. The same way that like a horoscope sometimes does.
Yes, exactly. And it gets to the point of, there's sort of so little about her, and she's so relatable that you can even jump the line of like, she's female and I'm male, and easily sort of be like, no, I'm her, and this is happening to me.
Mm-hmm. Did you eventually like have gay, gay characters that you were, I don't know, that you could read yourself into without having to read into like adding the like gender flipping or anything like that?
It took a very long time, honestly. I think because I was so in the habit of resisting coming out for those 20 years that I didn't want to know anything about gay culture. So growing up, not really, outside of the musicals I would do. Eventually I did come to find some gay role models later in my life. But like, all of my comedy influences were straight. A lot of my musical influences were straight. I was sort of stunted. I feel like a lot of gay people go through a second puberty as soon as they come out, where they learn so much about themselves and so much about the world. So it all sort of flooded in at once.
Yeah, well, and you would have been in a pretty interesting environment to experience that. Like, so you're at NYU, you're in the middle of New York. What was your, you know, you call it a second puberty or whatever you want, but like, what was your exploration of what gay is once you were ready to be like, all right, that's me?
It was so intense and so terrifying because, yeah, it was not jumping into the shallow end. It was jumping into the deep end. And I was scared. I had a friend take me to Nowhere Bar on 14th Street in Greenwich Village and take me to the bar. And I said, like, I want to meet gay people maybe to have a relationship with. And will you come escort me so I feel safe? And that night I actually, it was super nice of this friend, by the way, but this straight male friend who took me to the gay bar. But eventually I actually that night met my boyfriend, my first boyfriend, who would be my boyfriend for 3 months. And I told my straight friend he could let me be on my own. But it was very scary. There's so much in New York. There's you know, you could go down to the Eagle into a leather bar and see naked men, and I was just shy and scared and felt like I was 14 again. So I kind of hid away a little bit.
You know, what you're describing is, this is just something that's fresh in my mind because I was watching it. I was watching the Keanu Reeves, Gary Oldman interview with the vampire, like one does, earlier today, I guess getting ready for Halloween. And there's a scene where Keanu is like such a fresh-faced young puppy. He just seems like a surfer vampire hunter. And Gary Oldman is doing this very sinister, like swanning around the castle and being really like abstruse. And something about the vibe just really reminded me of exactly what you described, of like this fresh-faced young, like fresh meat twink coming into the scary culture that he doesn't fully understand, but he's curious about. Just like with a lot of questions and I don't know, like just sort of a menu unfurling. Now, obviously, like Bram Stoker's Dracula is a little more sinister than going to the gay bar. But what did you find that you were like, I don't know, that spoke to you in the same way that maybe Twilight did, or maybe in a different way that you were like, oh, this is right. This feels right.
I was very, very frightened at first, and then started to find actually just a really, really queer comedy scene. I think that's what actually made me feel comfortable in my own skin fully and finally. At the end of college, I started doing shows at a theater called The Annoyance New York, which was an offshoot of The Annoyance Chicago. And it was in a damp, dark basement where trash water would flow in through the staircase. It was so fun. It was grungy. It was a little black box. There was a bar in the back. And this was in Brooklyn. It wasn't in Manhattan. And there were a lot of young queer people finding different ways to express themselves. I think maybe what it was is that being gay for me was first and foremost about expression, not necessarily about sexuality or community at first. And so when I came out, I was a little bit scared to go to the gay bar and meet a ton of gay men to have relationships with. What I really wanted was to interface and express sort of who I am and introduce myself to everybody. So I got involved with this really grungy underground comedy scene in Brooklyn where everybody was everything and everybody was nothing. And it gave me a real sense of community of people who were a lot of different ways. I think that's what scared me on coming out was, and also scared me away from coming out for so long was, oh, if I come out, if I'm gay, I have to be a very specific kind of way. It'll happen to me. I'll be this exact person if I'm gay. And I don't know if I want that. So seeing so many young people sort of figuring it out, I think finally made me comfortable.
What sort of options did you perceive? Like you're going to the Eagle, you're going to Nowhere, the bar, you're finding comedians, which is, you know, that's kind of newish. Like, you know, that there would be like openly gay comics performing, you know, is not something I think that would have you'd have seen like a couple decades ago. So like what were the options? Like what were the ways to be gay that you saw and which ones felt right? And which ones were you like, not that?
Yeah, this wasn't too long ago. This was, when did I graduate from college? This must have been the 2010s, basically. Mm-hmm. There did, to a fresh new gay, there's one way of being gay. Unfortunately, it's the stereotype. It's very sexual. It's very hardcore and intense. And going to the most famous gay locations in Manhattan, you are going to see primarily that. I mean, because they are the most famous, most well-known spots. So I was very frightened at first. I saw the options for being gay as, okay, you go to the Eagle in your leather and you have public sex in front of people. First of all, that is awesome if you are into that. And I have many friends who are like that, but I am shy. underneath it all. That's a little hard to believe, I know, but I'm very shy and I wanted people to hold my hand and pat my head and comfort me into this experience. So yeah, it did. I mean, I hate to admit that I was prey to stereotypes about my own community, but I was really intimidated at first after coming out because I did kind of think that was the one option. And then I got to eventually through comedy meet a lot of people pursuing a lot of different options and felt like I could finally kind of just be myself.
How would you describe like what your comedy was? And had you done like comedy stuff in high school or like was it new as a college thing?
I did comedy in high school. I did improv, which was huge at that time. And I was always, you know, the funny role in the musical and the play. And I had started actually at 16 to do stand-up. And it was traditional style stand-ups, club stand-up, you might say. I remember I definitely told a joke that sort of had gay as the punchline when I wasn't out. And I remember receiving a really confused laugh for that one. Mm-hmm. Something about my little car engine sounding really gay in the pejorative. And the crowd, of course, who is reading me as a like gay teen, but maybe not, and maybe not out, gives me a very confused chuckle in response to that joke. Mm-hmm. But that was also sort of a mono option experience of gay comedy for a long time. There was very sitcom, very club comedy. It was rooted in identity comedy of, hey, the interesting thing about me is that I'm gay. And let me tell you a bunch of pretty on the nose jokes about what my experience is. And that's kind of the first way that the majority always interacts with the minority. Like you see these really scrubbed clean sitcoms on TV for that are featuring gay people like Will and Grace. But you also see that for like Black people. You'll see like the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air sort of introduced a very friendly to white people sitcom that they could sort of start to see people that didn't look like them but identify with them. So at first it started there. It started really rooted in that. And then after college, when I joined this huge community, I started to realize again that there were a lot of different options for how to express yourself as a person, as a comedian, as a gay person. And it didn't have to be rooted in the exact stuff that we've been seeing for decades.
Yeah. Like, how would you say your comedy evolved? And like, what is the, like, what kind of state is it in now? Like, how does it compare to what you're doing at first?
Well, at first, yes. At first, it was very, very club comedy. Very, very just spoken experiential things about who I was. Joining that community, what I'd call the Brooklyn Underground alt comedy community. Mm-hmm. What was prized was going wild and going wacky and going crazy. That was the best thing for me at that time. I'm so glad that I found that. It was about pushing it as far as it could go. I remember I did a sketch. I hosted a whole show where I played the role of a wretched little man who lived in the walls of the theater. And I wore tattered up underwear and a tattered up little tank top and sort of spoke like a golem kind of guy and did disgusting bits with like chocolate sauce all over my face. Mm-hmm. And that was extremely, extremely liberating. It was always sort of about one-upping all of your friends and doing the craziest thing in the night. Mm. That theater, that first theater, The Annoyance New York, unfortunately, closed pretty unceremoniously after a few years, like quite quickly. And we were all doing a lot of improv and sketch and working together. And I think everyone got a little bit shocked and said, oh, I need to do something that stars just me because you can't count on anyone in this world. So I just can count on myself. So there was a real snapback in that community to stand-up comedy in the traditional sense, but bringing a lot of those fun experimental ideas into it. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of love what it's become. And for my own comedy, I started to polish some of that experimental stuff, still do crazy characters, but also talk, you know, a little bit about my experience. I was finally ready to, in stand up, return to my talking about my experience and who I was, which has been really fun. And then for the last few years, I have been doing musical comedy, combining some of my great loves. And I think I finally kind of saw where my talents lie and what was unique about me. And that was the genesis of creating insane, experimental, often terrifying, but really catchy comedy pop music. And that is what I'm doing now. And I love doing it.
Yeah. So tell me about like some of the stuff that you've done recently. Like when people look at your, either your YouTube or I don't know, like where are you actually putting this? Because I don't even know what the world looks like. The media landscape looks like at this point, you know, given that we can't do like actual in-person appearances like we used to.
Yeah. Well, it is all over the place. I'm getting to do a little bit of in-person, which is very nice, but yeah, the media landscape is all over the place. And also the comedy music landscape is a bit disparate, but I'm doing some live shows. I'm releasing things online on YouTube, on Spotify, and of course across social media. And I'm creating this music. I'm now putting out my second EP. I'm very excited for it. It's coming out fully on October 22nd, with some singles coming out before. And the music is all pop music and should sound like pop music that you would actually listen to, with some insane, wild, comedic, hilarious premises running throughout the lyrics. I like to toe that line. My favorite response to get back is either backhandedly complimenting the music or the comedy in one order or another. I hear all the time, like, hey man, I listened to your song. It was so funny. But then I was like, wait a minute, this actually sounds really good. people say that all the time to me. And I it is quite backhanded, but I do not consider it backhanded. I love it so much because you don't expect it to sound like something you would listen to if it wasn't funny. When it's supposed to be comedy music, you go, okay, it's comedy or it's music I would listen to. It can't be both, but that's the goal. That's what I've been doing lately. I hope I'm succeeding.
How queer is it?
It is very, very queer. It's just a running theme in my life, and it comes out in everything. Whether that is a song on the album, I have two very, very gay songs on the album. One is called No Homo, actually. And playing sort of with that joke that we've kind of heard a million times of no homo, but I'm into you, dude. No homo, no homo. Sort of crossing that line. But my version of it has a bit of a twist. I'll save that surprise for listeners. But also, I realized no one's really touched it for a few years, that subject matter or that joke. There have been comedy songs called No Homo. There's actually a fairly popular Lonely Island song called No Homo. And I don't find it horribly, horribly offensive. But I wrote this song and I got a little bit scared and said, I've already kind of seen this. The song with the title exists. But I got really excited actually to reclaim that joke for me. I'm not out here canceling the Lonely Island. I am actually huge fans of the Lonely Island, but and I don't think they did anything wrong with that song. I actually think it's fairly respectful, but I am of the opinion that comedians are welcome to talk about other people, but the sharpest, best version of the joke about a group of people is going to come from somebody who is within that group of people. So I got really excited to sort of do my version of this exactly the way I wanted it and to reclaim it.
When you do these videos and when you do the songs, do you find yourself playing a character, or like how much is just you and how much of it is like a persona? And did you find it's the same persona from like one thing to the other?
It kind of is the same persona from one thing to the other. And that happened a little bit organically. It is me at my worst.
Okay, that's fun.
Yeah, that's who I like to be. And I think it's because I think a lot of people have these thoughts that they wish they didn't have, that they feel guilty for having, whether mm-hmm. that's, you know, something actually bad, like, I want to get revenge on this person, I'm so mad at them, or wouldn't it be great if I could take advantage of people to get ahead? Or if it's as innocent as, like, I'm ashamed for liking this thing, or I'm having gay feelings and thoughts, and I don't know how to process them.
Oh, but yeah, I mean, it's just like what you felt with Twilight.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that most people have this version of themselves that they don't show people, and they think that it is actually their true selves, and they're horrified by that person. They mm-hmm. think that person's a bad person.
Oh, they don't want to show their shadow.
Oh, okay. Episode title. Yeah, I think they're afraid of that shadow. They don't want anyone to find them out and realize how bad they are and that they're not deserving of love. And so it's very therapeutic, but also fun and, you know, endlessly comedic to play songs from the perspective of, what if I was this bad of a person? What if I let all of those impulses go and I did everything bad that I wanted to do? What if I slept with someone's dad? What if I killed someone for being basic compared to me? I even have a song on there that is basically just, what if I did whatever I wanted whenever I wanted to?
Yeah, so like these are the sort of indulgences that I think a lot of people just fantasize about in general. But you know, being like, what if I cast off these like arbitrary limits on me? That feels super gay.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. I mean, yeah, that song No Homo, which I'm actually putting out a music video and single for this week, which I'm really excited for, is playing with that concept of dipping your foot into being gay and having that out, being able to backpedal if you really need to, mm-hmm. and maybe comedically even feeling like you still have that freedom when you've definitely crossed a certain line and you have fully indulged in being gay.
Is there something that you haven't done yet that you've been wanting to? Is there like a dream project or like a next video or a next song that you're just kind of like looking to the future that you want to do at some point?
Absolutely. I'm cheating a little bit because on the day my album releases, the 22nd of October, I'm also doing a big show in New York that is kind of this, but the first version of this. My dream is to put on a live show or, you know, recorded sort of special, which is a concert can have a band on it with incredible banter between songs who's really entertaining and charismatic. They take sometimes, you know, 3 to 5 minutes between songs to tell you an anecdote from the tour or something they know is going to get a laugh or something they want to share with you. And mm-hmm. I consider that format of sharing stories, of storytelling, to be almost exactly the same thing as stand-up comedy. It is really very similar in form. And so my dream is to fully do a concert and stadium comedy performance that is my comedy music with anecdotal and not stand up in between the songs as the banter, as the interface with the crowd. And of course, I want to do it at the level of Ariana Grande, Britney Spears, Lady Gaga. I want to do this super high production value, big concert for pop music. The only difference is it also is comedy pop music and an extremely hilarious hour. So mm-hmm. that would be my dream.
You're kind of describing like cabaret style performance. Like I've seen shows often like with drag queens hosting, but not always.
Yeah.
But like sort of like a comedy variety show it sounds like that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. And honestly, I thought I was so original. I was late-ish to the Drag Race game. I had not seen any of it before pandemic, and I have now seen literally all of it. And I realized how, whether I knew it or not, how much influence what I do takes from drag. Mm. And like credit where credit is due. I think that it's a little different in some ways, but Now I'm going to drag shows all the time because they are endlessly inspiring for what I want to do. These girls are incredible performers. They are world-class singers and dancers. Not all of them singers, but some of them are world-class singers. I realize that's, I'm kind of excited to bring one aspect of that, though it's not drag, it's coming from a queer perspective, and sort of show it to the world and say, this has been happening for a long time now in these communities, you just don't know about it, and isn't it incredible?
Yeah, so if folks want to check you out and see if you are doing appearances or if you're just online, like where should they go? Where can they find your stuff?
I do have a big live appearance coming up. If you are in New York City on October 22nd, I am doing a big show at Union Hall. Come swing by. It's hosted and featuring some very incredible comedians that I know and love. And then other than that, check me out on YouTube and Spotify. You can search Ian Lockwood Comedy on YouTube or just Ian Lockwood on Spotify. You'll find me, I promise. I'm going to be releasing things probably through the end of the year and some very, very fun, high production looking, insane, maybe scary music videos. And I think people are going to like them a lot.
That sounds great. Ian, thanks so much for joining me.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks to Ian for joining me, and thanks to you for listening. And thanks to everybody who makes the Sewers of Paris possible on Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/MattBaume to support the show and get back rewards like stickers in the mail and exclusive bonus videos. Check out my YouTube for deep dives into queer pop culture history at youtube.com/MattBaume and my newsletter at mattbaume.com. The theme song for The Sewers of Paris is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin MacLeod of incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Parisian 4.0. And until next time, croissant.